It is Monday, December the 26th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Coming up, the UN addressing Israeli settlements in occupied territories.
The mere fact that it is enshrined in a Security Council resolution has driven Prime Minister Netanyahu apoplectic. So there is a real disconnect.
Also ahead, social media reaction to the death of singer-songwriter George Michael, the many holiday celebrations on social media, plus some of the season's sounds. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. The Israeli government's reaction to the UN Security Council's adoption of a resolution opposing Jewish settlements in occupied territory underscores its fundamental dispute with the international community about the future of the West Bank as well as East Jerusalem. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu insists there is nothing wrong with this policy of building Jewish towns in occupied areas that the Palestinians, with overwhelming world support, claim for their state. Mr. Netanyahu routinely dismisses international criticism of the settlements, but not this time. In fact, he is on a campaign, he says, to punish the countries that took part in the resolution. He has called in the UN U.S. ambassador to Israel to discuss the U.S. abstaining from Friday's vote on the resolution. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Middle East scholar Michael Fishbach of Randolph-Macon College if Israel's reaction to the resolution passing is extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. I think it's extraordinary for a couple of reasons. The first of all is that the Security Council hasn't adopted a resolution criticizing or condemning settlements for many, many years. And there's been an unwritten agreement from administrations in the United States, both Republican and Democratic, that in the final analysis, the U.S. would shield Israel from negative Security Council resolutions. So the mere act of abstaining itself is remarkable. Now, that's on a diplomatic level. As far as what it means on the ground, or whether Palestinians should consider it a victory, is a whole other matter. But just on the surface of it, it was fairly remarkable. The Israeli reaction, while predictable, is in some ways remarkable. And the fact that all this is coming in the waning days of an American presidential administration is even more remarkable. And the open lobbying by the president-elect, Donald Trump, to try to the United States to back away from this resolution, the frustration of the Obama administration over the years, culminating here at the very end of his administration, all make this a very, in many ways, unprecedented scene. And it's very interesting to watch it unfold.
Well, it's interesting that it came just weeks before the Obama administration leaves office.
Well, that is what is unprecedented about this. There were many hopes from certainly people who had an interest in advancing the peace process, certainly the Palestinians, in 2009 that the Obama administration would be different. And there were some early signals that he intended to really push forward on the resolution of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. His legendarily frosty relationship with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu seemed to signal that the United States might, in fact, be moving to pressure Israel. The reality played out quite differently. The Obama administration signed the largest ever foreign arms deal in American history, and it was with Israel. The Obama administration essentially failed, both under George Mitchell and John Kerry, to advance the peace process, and despite all the bluster, really provided Israel with this significant diplomatic cover, particularly during the Gaza War of 2014. So here at the very end, one wonders if, to what extent, the Obama administration's actions in this instance reflect an attempt to thumb his nose at Benjamin Netanyahu here at the end, or an attempt to thumb his nose at Donald Trump, who has announced that starting January 20th, Israel will be even higher on the friendship level with the United States, or to some degree he's thumbing his nose at both.
Here's the take of a professor at Hebrew University. Quote, the importance of the resolution is to remind Israel, at least at the rhetorical level, that the international community is not completely happy, to say the least, with the ongoing status quo. This resolution is about settlement activities, the two-state solution, and ending the occupation. Netanyahu, by his statements and actions, is isolating Israel for the sake of settlements.
I think in the final analysis for the prime minister, it was a major political defeat. And for his opponents, internal opponents in Israel, it provides an opening for a renewal of calls, particularly on the Israeli left, to have him, you know, have to account for this significant failure.
Michael, there were no punitive actions mentioned in the resolution. There will be no sanction that Israel has to face. Another Hebrew University professor suggests that there were some positive elements in the resolution for Israel. It endorses the idea of territorial swaps. Israel could keep some settlements, perhaps, as part of a negotiated peace deal, and the differentiation between Israel proper and the settlements signal the unlikely in the past Israel was no longer being forced to defend its right to exist.
Well, this has been pointed out by, yes, you're right, both Israeli commentators and some others, including Palestinians, that for all of the brouhaha, really the resolution just enshrines what has become a fairly accepted international understanding of where a peaceful solution lies. There really isn't much radical in it. And yet that the mere fact that it is enshrined in a Security Council resolution has driven Prime Minister Netanyahu apoplectic. So there is a real disconnect between what the resolution really says, the lack of accountability in terms of sanctions, punitive actions, and this virulent Israeli reaction. And part of that, I might add, is, and some Israeli commentators have pointed this out, a fear that the upcoming January 15th meeting of foreign ministers in Paris might lead to some sort of Franco-American-led effort to create a set of parameters for a peace solution that could be given to the Security Council for a vote prior to the January 20th administration of Donald Trump. So part of the reaction, which is so virulent, is fear that this is going to be followed up in a 1-2 punch with something else coming up before the Security Council in January.
Michael Fischbach is a professor of history at Randolph-Macon College, and he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. It is the time. It's time right now for a special social media segment, so to speak, which begins today with a major loss for international pop music. That is the death of British singer-songwriter and gay icon George Michael, who died at his home in England at the age of 53. My colleague Michael Lippin is here with a social media reaction. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Steve. It's a rather sad note to begin our social media conversation on Christmas Day. George Michael, a British singer who I got to know and love as part of that British group Wham and then as a solo artist, produced some of the best pop hits of the 80s and 90s, and the social media world is recognizing that achievement by making him the top trending item on Twitter and Facebook, with about 1 million people talking about him so far on each platform. On Instagram, British pop superstar Elton John posted a photo of him with Michael, along with this note. I am in deep shock. I have lost a beloved friend, the kindest, most generous soul, and a brilliant artist. My heart goes out to his family, friends, and all of his fans. George Michael, rest in peace. You know, George Michael had his own Twitter account with 597,000 followers. He last tweeted on September 28th, linking to an article by Vogue magazine about his 1990 hit music video Freedom getting updated with a new team of supermodels. You remember that video, Steve?
Oh, man, do I ever remember it. I mean, it was new. I wasn't a big music video fan.
Uh-huh.
But this one was amazing. These supermodels of the era, I don't remember any of their names, but they were indeed beautiful.
They were stunning.
And in all types of attire.
That's or lack of attire, I remember.
It was spectacular, to say the least. Yeah.
So, you know, in October this year, two New York designers picked a new generation of supermodels to lip sync to that song on the streets of New York, and the video is pretty impressive. Michael himself liked it, saying this in his September tweet, "Enjoy, this is special. Love, George." You know, another of George Michael's biggest hits was, as part of Wham, the song Last Christmas. It seems bizarre to me that that he should have died on Christmas itself,
really,
given the enormous popularity of that 1984 song. Now, Twitter user Matthew Lumby posted this note about Last Christmas. "Time to download Wham's Last Christmas so that the best ever number two chart song finally gets to number one as a tribute to George Michael." And he's right about that. It did never get to the top of the British charts. Maybe it will now.
Yeah, indeed. More than likely. Well, this is a big holiday period for the people of the world. On social media, I'm sure. What else is out there?
Well, there's another holiday that's trending, and of course it is Hanukkah. It is the second night of the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah, with lots of people tweeting about it, including U.S. political figures like President-elect Donald Trump and Secretary of State John Kerry. It's also getting a lot of attention on Facebook today because of a lighting of a huge Hanukkah menorah, or candelabra, in a park next to the White House. I was actually at that event today, and I spoke to one of the organizers from the Orthodox Jewish group Chabad Lubavitch, and I asked the rabbi Menachem Shemtov what he thought of the lighting event, which included musical performances and took place under sunny skies, as well as coinciding with Christmas Day.
The event went quite well tonight. It was our biggest ever. It probably has to do with the timing of this year, the way that it turned out. But we had over 5,000 people in attendance and many on wait lists that unfortunately weren't able to come in.
Is that a record for you?
That is a record for us. The numbers are phenomenal. And we want to just spread the message of Hanukkah. So the more that we have is always the better.
About that message of Hanukkah, a lot of our audience lives in Asia, in Africa. They may not know so much about Hanukkah. How could you explain what does this Jewish holiday mean?
Well, I could go on forever talking about Hanukkah, but in very short, Hanukkah is about the victory that the Jews had many years ago when we were persecuted, and we were very few. We were very few in numbers. Some estimates put us as that low at 50,000, and we overcame the largest army in the world and miraculously won. And when we entered our temple to rededicate it, there was one jug of oil left. And the way it used to work in the temple, we used to light a menorah, like what we have back here.
Yeah, you can actually see the menorah is behind us, but the lighting is off, but there are some people working up there right now.
So that menorah used to be lit, and there was only one jug left. And they didn't know what to do, because it would take about a week for them to get new oil. And there was a miracle that happened, that this one jug lasted for eight nights. It lasted 7 nights extra. And for us, we like to spread that message every single year. And we have that tradition since then that we light our own in our house to commemorate that miracle, the message of light over darkness, the message of spreading it around the world.
Those menorahs are not quite as big as the one we have here. They're usually a lot smaller. A menorah is a candelabra with nine branches. And tell us, you know, why is it important for Jewish people, for American Jews, to actually spread the message of Hanukkah to non-Jewish people?
Because the message of Hanukkah is actually a very universal one. It's the concept of, even when there's a dark world, when there's evil around us, when things aren't so great, if we light one candle and we light a full menorah, and every night we light another one and another one and another one, it's the message that applies to everyone, that even a little bit of darkness can dispel, a little bit of light, sorry, can dispel a lot of darkness. So that message doesn't just apply to us, it applies to everyone in the world. And the message of Hanukkah, it is actually told that we're supposed to spread it as far as possible. So it applies to us, it applies to Jews, it applies to non-Jews, it applies to everyone in the world.
Speaking of spreading as far as possible, your organization, the Chabad Lubavitch Movement, tell our audience a bit about it. And, you know, what makes it distinctive in Judaism, and how much of a presence you have around the world?
So it's actually quite a large presence. There are over 4,000 Chabad emissaries around the world in locations from China to Kenya, from South Africa all over Europe, all over the place, in over 90 countries, and every single state in America has a Chabad emissary there, spreading this message. And Hanukkah, we like to have public lightings wherever the local public square or area is, and this one being the most prominent one in America, perhaps, that's why we like to do it here every year annually.
That was Rabbi Menachem Shem Tov speaking with me earlier today, and all that's left for me to say is Merry Christmas to you, Steve, and Happy Hanukkah to everyone else celebrating.
Absolutely. So many thanks, Michael. Yes, happy holidays to everyone from me as well. I thought it might be nice as we move along with the events of a big holiday weekend by listening to the Washington Gay Men's Chorus singing a song of Hanukkah. The Hanukkah festival commemorates a victory by outnumbered Jewish forces over Syrian occupation and the reclaiming of the Second Temple of Jerusalem in the 2nd century B.C. Each year, the 8-branched menorah is lit, adding one candle each night during the 8-day holiday. And today begins the week-long celebration of Kwanzaa. It is celebrated in the United States and other nations of the West African diaspora in the Americas. It honors African heritage and the African American culture and is observed from December 26th to January 1st. It culminates in a feast and gift-giving. Kwanzaa has 7 core principles. They are unity, self-determination, collective work and responsibility, cooperative economics, purpose, creativity, and faith. It was created by Maulana Karenga and was first celebrated in the mid-1960s. President Obama and U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama used the White House weekly address over the weekend to reflect on the president's 8 years in office, also to recognize U.S. troops serving around the world, and to honor the values of what they called boundless love, compassion, and hope over the Christmas holiday. It was the Obamas' last Christmas address.
Celebrating the holidays in the White House over these past 8 years has been a true privilege. We've been able to welcome over 500,000 guests. Our outstanding pastry chefs have baked 200,000 holiday cookies.
That's a lot of cookies.
And Barack has treated the American people to countless dad jokes.
They're great jokes.
Not so funny.
Although a few got a frosty reception.
Oh, the last one. This year's White House holiday theme is the gift of the holidays. And our decorations reflect some of our greatest gifts as a nation, from our incredible military families to the life-changing impact of a great education.
And the greatest gift that Michelle and I have received over the last 8 years has been the honor of serving as your president and first lady. Together, we fought our way back from the worst recession in 80 years and got unemployment to a 9-year low. We secured health insurance for another 20 million Americans and new protections for folks who already had insurance. We made America more respected around the world, took on the mantle of leadership in the fight to protect this planet for our kids, and much, much more. By so many measures, our country is stronger and more prosperous than it was when we first got here. And I'm hopeful we'll build on the progress we've made together in the years to come. Tomorrow, for the final time as the first family, we will join our fellow Christians around the world to rejoice in the birth of our Savior. And as we retell his story from that holy night, we'll also remember his eternal message, one of boundless love, compassion, and hope.
The idea that we are our brother's keeper and our sister's keeper, that we should treat others as we would want to be treated, that we care for the sick, feed the hungry, welcome the stranger, no matter where they come from or how they practice their faith.
Those are values that help guide not just my family's Christian faith, but that of Jewish Americans and Muslim Americans, non-believers and Americans of all backgrounds. And no one better embodies that spirit of service than the men and women who wear our country's uniform and their families.
As always, many of our troops are far from home this time of the year, and their families are serving and sacrificing right along with them. Their courage and dedication allow the rest of us to enjoy the season. That's why we tried to serve them as well as they've served this country.
So as we look forward to the new year, let's resolve to recommit ourselves to the values we share. And on behalf of all the Obamas, Michelle, Malia, Sasha, Beau, and that troublemaker, Sonny, Merry Christmas, everybody.
And we wish you and your family a happy and healthy 2017. Thanks, and God bless.
President and Mrs. Obama speaking to the nation over the weekend.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Prospero año y felicidad. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas from the bottom of my heart. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas from the bottom of my heart.
Music is a big part of the holiday tradition. And singer-songwriter Jose Feliciano's Feliz Navidad is one of the most popular new Christmas classics.
Ha-ha! Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Prospero año y felicidad.
At a point when his career had been sagging for some time, Feliciano wrote Feliz Navidad. That was in 1970. And even today, it gets tens of thousands of downloads every Christmas.
I don't want a lot for Christmas. There is just one thing I need. I don't care about the presents underneath the Christmas tree. I just want you for my own. Make my wish come true. All I want for Christmas is you.
Then in 1994, singer Mariah Carey and composer Walter Afanasieff wrote All I Want for Christmas Is You, and the world had a new Christmas classic. Who celebrate Christmas, almost all of them love the traditional songs such as Silent Night and Joy to the World. But they also embrace in a major way the new classics, one of which came from Bob Wells and Mel Torme, who in 1945 wrote what quickly became one of the most popular holiday songs of all times, simply titled The Christmas Song, sung here by Aaron Neville.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Jack Frost nipping at your nose. Yuletide carols being sung by a choir. And oh, dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey.
Nice, isn't it, huh? Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news, it's straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope that you have a great Monday. Now, let's listen to a little more of Aaron Neville's The Christmas Song.
They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh. And every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer really know how to fly. And so I'm offering a simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92. Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you. They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh. And every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer really know how to fly. And so I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The fight against corruption must become central to the broader strategy against terrorism, said Undersecretary of State for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell. Corruption, she said, undermines the struggle against terrorism at every level. Corruption fuels new terrorist threats, often in the form of violent extremism. When public officials and businesses can demand bribes with the assurance of impunity, the compact between citizens and government is broken. This enables terrorists to cast themselves as a better deal. As Secretary of State Kerry has said many times, there is nothing more demoralizing, more destructive, more disempowering to a citizen than the belief that the system is rigged against them. Over the past 15 years in Afghanistan, for example, the Taliban has been able to replenish its fighters by exploiting discontent with government corruption. The Department of State's research on Africa found that personal experiences with corruption were significantly linked to political violence, including violent extremism. Corruption helps existing terrorist groups sustain operations and infiltrate new areas. In Mosul, for example, smuggled oil enriched the Islamic State as it attempted to seize the city. In Eastern Europe, foreign terrorist fighters have bribed border guards on their path to jihad. Across West Africa, there have been reports of soldiers selling weapons on the black market to Boko Haram, or even tipping off Al-Qaeda about future troop deployments for a fee. Finally, corruption saps the government's ability to combat terrorist threats and ensure national security. For example, when Nigerian President Buhari took office last year, he found an army hollowed out by graft and wholly incapable of confronting Boko Haram. When Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi assumed power in Iraq, he found 50,000 ghost soldiers on the payroll, draining precious resources from the fight against the Islamic State. For all of these reasons, Secretary of State John Kerry has called the fight against corruption a national security priority. For years, the world has looked at corruption as a threat to economic growth and human rights, said Undersecretary Sewell. But we have underestimated the threat. Corruption is far more dangerous than many realize, and it is time to confront it with the urgency, intensity, and resources it deserves. In doing so, We can help build societies that are not only more transparent and accountable, but are also more secure and safe from the threat of terrorism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.